So, okay, we are a speaker meeting, and I'm delighted to say that we do have a speaker this evening. It falls on me to introduce them. I met this gentleman actually just before the pandemic in the West Country. He's a friend of a friend of mine, and we kind of got on, and then fairly recently we bumped into each other again, and he asked me a question. I said, yeah, that's cool. We can do that. Please come and share for us. And he said, yes. It's taken a while to kind of get all that in the ducks in a row, so everyone was happy that we were doing what we were doing. And it's I'm pleased to say he's with us this evening to share his experience, strength and hope with us for 40 or 45 minutes, whatever he's comfortable with, and talk to us about his clean date and his clean time. So without further ado, Raymond, if you'd like to unmute yourself, there you go, unmute. Please jump in and share with us, please, my friend, and the floor is yours.
That's great. Thanks very much, Steve. My name's Raymond Addit.
Hi, Raymond.
All right, guys. Nice to be on the meeting. Wow, 40, 45 minutes. My God, that's a long time. But, yeah, so it's really good to be here. And Steve asked me to share a while ago, and we finally got to the point where I'm actually sharing. There's a couple of mates on here, actually, that I can see. So just big shout out to them, and thanks very much for just giving the opportunity to share my experience, strength and hope. So I'll start from childhood and end up to today, I suspect, or something like that. But so I was brought up in Oxfordshire, my mum was a Scouser, a Jewish Scouser, and my dad was a Glaswegian. And mum left when I was four, and then my dad raised me, and we had quite a wild house. There was all these dodgy people coming into our house, and thieves, and it wasn't so much addicts those days. There was a few people getting into a bit of drugs, but it wasn't like it was these days. And we're talking about the 70s here, so grew up in a house where there was a bar and there was a pool table, and my father would just bring people back from the pubs, and there'd be big parties and drinking and karaoke. My man used to have a radiogram with a microphone, and they used to all take in turns singing, just getting drunk and sort of having parties, having good times. It was in the days where working men had spare money to go out and be able to drink and feed their families and pay their bills and, go on holiday and all that stuff. Unfortunately, we don't have those days anymore. I'm not saying that I encourage drinking or partying, but I'm saying that you should be able to afford to look after your children and your families. But unfortunately, times are difficult. That's my little rant on that one. But, soon what was happening was my father was going out and leaving us with unsavoury characters, and both my brother and I got sexually abused by somebody, and so I was kind of damaged very young. And I remember my dad was going out, and I was saying to him, please don't go out to my dad. And he was going, I'm going to have a drink with the lads and all this stuff. And I was sort of saying, please don't go out tonight, because I was getting sexually abused. And so what I'd done is I stole all his money off the side, and I went out in the street, and I bought a load of kids some sweeties. And then next thing, everyone was saying, your dad's looking for you. And basically, I got belted. And I was, I just guess there was a hardening of my heart there and then. I kind of, I remember tearing up and looking at my father and thinking, if you knew what was going on. But I wasn't able to tell him what was going on. So I was kind of getting punished. And then I was getting left with somebody who was sexually abusing my brother and I. And, that started to really sort of have an effect on my life as a young boy. What happened was my dad took in some people, and they were robbing the hospitals, but they were also getting these nurses to steal the drugs for them. And this guy decides not to do the robberies anymore. So they decided to beat him to death and killed him and set him on fire between two mattresses. And the next thing, social services are on us, and Yeah, we had a surgery service having a close eye on us. And but what happened in all this was, I kind of realised that people weren't very nice. Not everybody was nice, you know. And so I started to get a sort of hardness around me, I guess, and a protection. Anyway, so I started to get to the point where, like, my uncles and that would give me drink. And what they would do was they'd bring people back from the pub and they would have pool tables and card games and all that. And then they'd get my brother and I to, they'd wake us up and they would get us to box each other, to the point where we were just crying, and they'd be betting on us and stuff like that. We'd just be tearing up. My uncle would take me in another room and say, look, eat this honey, you'll go, it'll make you stronger, you're going to win now, and all this. And kind of just, it was just abusive. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, now you think, like in the 70s, people were thinking this is going to toughen your boys up. But now I've been trained in safeguarding all that stuff. And I think, my God, that was so abusive what we used to go through, you know. And it conditioned me into a certain way. And then I started to get taught how to be a thief. We used to have all these scousers come to our house, and they would, often they'd be on the run. And it was almost like my dad had this place where it was a safe house for people. And they taught me how to do crime, pay crime and burglaries and stuff like that. And because I was a small lad, they'd sort of get up there, open that window, get in here, let's open that door, you know. And they were getting me to do like offices and all that sort of stuff. And then they give me money. And I just had this sort of criminality around me then, sort of influence into my life. So I'd be going to school and, you know, I'd be nicking stuff and selling it and doing a bit of this and that. And, you know, turning up to school with all the fashion on and all that stuff, you know. And I'm talking about 13, 14, 15, you know, I'd be going up with, you know, I'd have like all the clothes, and I'd be able to get into nightclubs because all the old people knew me, and they thought, well, he can't be young because he's got all the clothes and all that stuff. So that was kind of start to become an identity for me. And then, you know, I started doing drinking, started solvent abuse, and then I started getting older with a bit of puff. And then we started to learn there was a front line up in Reading. So started getting up there and scoring, getting into the drugs. And it just got old for me straight away. And, you know, by the time I was 17, I was thinking, man, I'm in trouble. It was an everyday occurrence straight away. I just couldn't help it. I wanted more and more and more. And I got to the point where I started to think, what am I going to do? And I tried to sign up in the army. But when I went up to the army office to sign up, first of all, the guy didn't take me seriously. And I sort of said to him, look, my granddad was a regimental sergeant major. My cousins are paratroopers and Marines and all this stuff. I'm serious, you know. And I'd been a cadet anyway. And he said, look, you know, he saw I was serious. And he said, look, when you come back after, because I had 3 court cases going, and he said, come back when you do your court cases and then sign up. And unfortunately, I never got there because I just got taken away with the drug scene. So in, like, I can remember, I will say in 1987, I was at Glastonbury, you know, and I was doing acid and speed and all that stuff and puffing out and magic mushrooms and, you know, tripping out all over the place and just sort of like, just, yeah, living, I lived rough for a while and used to sleep down the river and all that stuff. I just used to get high all the time. And I was going out at night and doing crime and all this stuff. So I kind of, you know, and next thing, like 18 and 19, Acid House come along. And that was me, you know. I was just gone. Took my first ecstasy tablet and, I just went clubbing and, you know, just ran around doing this, that and the other and, you know, pay crime, really. I like to think I was a gangster, but I wasn't really. You know, I just, I was around stuff, you know, and I knew some dodgy people and I kind of was, people would consider me to be dodgy, but, you know, we all know how far this goes in that way. So anyway, I started really getting messed up on the ecstasy. And first of all, it was all peace and love and, you know, everybody was having the summer of love and all this stuff. And then then you start to meet people getting robbed, people getting stabbed, people getting, you know, yeah, taken out, and petrol bombings and all that. This is around my area where I grew up, you know. And it, so that sort of just, that element of peace and love just went after about 2 years. So by sort of 91, 92, I was kind of starting to become mentally ill, really. I was just really poorly. I wasn't eating. You know, I never looked after myself. I had no self-care. So from someone that was like really into fashion and all that stuff, and all of a sudden I'm walking around with rags and I'm a mess, you know, and always in court, always in the police cells, always getting arrested, always getting pulled over, blah, blah, blah. You know, and started getting sick and tired of the drug scene. Basically everyone I touched was, I was ripping people off with drug money, and I was scoring and then not paying it back, and then I was getting lay-ons and spending it and doing it in, and you know, just out of control. And then I'll be, you know, next thing I'm running away from every dealer in the city and every dealer in the county, and running, moving up here and moving there, and I'm just completely like paranoid, you know, all the time, just thinking I'm going to get caught up with. And the only thing I could do is keep taking drugs, you know, and I was in a terrible mental state, really, and, you know, trying to front it out as if I had control. And then I got in with some people, and somebody got murdered and ended up in Crown Court. And then this court case was going on, and then unfortunately my brother died from drugs, and he was 11 months older than me, and so here I am, I'm in the middle of a court case, my brother's died in my arms, I've got everybody after me, I'm a complete mess, and then, you know, I got thrown a line of hope, and I got offered to go into a treatment centre. So I was 24 at the time. And so I went to the treatment centre. When I arrived there, I was 6 stone 10, and I was very poorly, and yeah, just really just scared, and just someone looked at me, this guy, and he said, "You just look like hardened. I look like I've been in a prisoner of war camp. I had a bald head, skinhead, 6 stone 10, and I was emaciated. I was paranoid, and I was just hard looking." And I just look, you know, I just look right into people, and I just was just hardened by the world and my experiences, really. Anyway, I'd done treatment there, and I was there for 9 months. I got fit as a fiddle. I was 10.5 stone by the time I left, and I was running a half marathon, doing half marathons, and fit as a fiddle, you know, and kind of just fit enough to go out and do another run again, basically. So, you know, I got kicked out because I used, and anyway, I moved up to London again, and just got connected all up to the wrong people again, and started running around with undesirables, and, you know, my life was nightclubs. You know, it stops. Before I went to work, I used to take espresso and Zambuca in the morning to stop me shaking. And then I'd get on with my work, and all I was thinking is just I need some money so I can score, you know. And I was into, you know, powders and crack cocaine and all that stuff. And all I thought about it was the getting and using and finding ways and means to get more. And I got in trouble with some people. Basically, I stabbed a bloke in London. Basically, they were going to do me in. So what was I going to do? I stabbed this guy. I got out of there. And my mum lived in America. And I always felt she owed me. So I sort of phoned her up and said, look, you know, you need to get me out of London. I've got these people after me. And I went out to America. She used to live in New York. And I stayed there for a while. Kind of got myself back together. And then I come back to London and just carried on as usual. Carried on using. You know, I didn't know what else to do. I had no other desire, really, apart from to sort of just run the race again, and carried on. And then it all got on top of me again. I had some people after me in London, And I just, my cousin, he come down and he said, Ray, if you don't get out of London, you're going to be dead. And he said, why don't you come down to where I am in the West Country? And he lived in Exeter, he was from Glasgow. The reason why people ask, oh, why did you end up in the West Country? The truth of the matter is, we got sent. One of my relatives got sentenced to jail here, basically. You know, and what my family was either you go to jail or you go in the army. You know, and you know, basically, I got offered to come down here, and I've said no, of course, and then a few more things happened, and I thought, you know what, I'm just going to go down there, and I'm just going to get my shit together. So I kind of went down and I turned up with a bag and a few hundred quid. It was really strange because what happened was in London, it was like everything I wanted was happening. And then all of a sudden it wasn't. So one minute I had free access to clubs. I had drugs, you know, that I could get hold of any time. I had some really good connections of so-called, you know, drug dealers and, you know, good crowd I was hanging out with, and it all seemed really glamorous. And what happened was, it was almost like the more glamorous and the more it looked to everyone else in the outside world, you know, the shiny sort of like, you know, get up and prestige of nightclubs and, you know, connections and all that stuff, the more rotten I was inside. And I always liken it to the picture of Dorian Gray, you know, you know, the more beautiful it looks, the more ugly it gets. And that's kind of what happened with me. So I ended up coming down to the West Country, and I was still using, and managed to sort of get myself a little shop together, a business. And I just used to just get, as soon as I got money, I just used it. And I remember many times I was just sitting in this staff room, and there'd just be mirrors on the floor and powder and cans everywhere, and me crying with loud music on, just lonely, just gone, just felt like, what is this all about? And just like disconnected, you know. My dad died there, another one of my brothers died, and I kind of just felt like, what is going on, you know? And I guess I got the gift of desperation. I kind of asked for help. I remember I went to a nightclub, my mate come down. I got married to my now wife. We've been married 20 years by a miracle, certainly, because she's a wonderful person and very gracious. But I got married, and about 2 months after I got married, I kind of remember saying to my wife, well, I'm fucking bored of you. And my mate turned up from Oxford, and he's like a known hooligan. We went out, and of course, we ended up getting tanked up and using all night. And then we ended up in a nightclub and fighting with the bouncers. And if you saw me, you would see that I'm not a very good guy to be fighting bouncers. But anyway, that's what happened. I ended up waking up in the cells one day, and I just thought, I have had enough of this. I've been coming in and out of the cells for like 20 years, you know, on and off, and various cities, various crimes and various silly things, you know. And I just woke up and I thought, I've had enough of this. So I got out of the cell, and my mate said, come on, let's go down the pub. And I said, that's it, I've had enough. And he laughed at me, said that. And I said, no, I mean it, I've had enough. And I phoned up my cousin who was in recovery, and I said, you know, you go to those meetings, what's that all about? And he said, oh, blah, blah, blah. And he told me all about it. He said, you know, I got well. And he was a raging alcoholic, and he'd been in jail 17 years, and all of a sudden he's got his life back in order, very evidently in front of me. And So I said, look, I need to go to those meetings. And he said, yeah, I'm going on Wednesday. This was a Monday. I said, no, I need to go today. This is the day. I need to go today. You know, and what it was is, when I got out of sales, and I think I had 11 quid left, and there was a shop around the corner that was selling wine, two bottles for a tenner. And I was just going to get tanked up. And what happened was, my daughter asked me, can I have my pocket money? And I just didn't want to give her it. And I wanted to drink it. And I said, yeah, of course you can, love, you know. And she went out the door, and I just cried my eyes out. And I just thought, man, I just got to get a life. I just got to get myself a life here. So, you know, I ended up phoning my cousin, as I said, and went to the meeting. And I'd like to say I stopped using, but I didn't. I stayed clean for about 3 months, was going to the meetings, And then I just, you know, I just used again. I think I was using for, I don't know, about another year or something. And then I just, you know, I had enough. What happened was my dad had died and I was losing it. I was getting in trouble. I was just spoiling for trouble. I could see it coming, you know, and they say you can see a shadow of the things that are going to come. And I kind of felt that if I don't get myself together, I'm going to end up dead. I'm going to end up either in jail, in an institution, or die. And I could just see it. And there was no denying it. It was the end of the road. And so I started going to NA. And I remember going to my first NA meeting, and I was just petrified. What it was is I went in this room and, you know, I was just vulnerable and scared and I didn't understand what was going to happen. But I remember this lad was sharing and he said, oh, my name's Rob and I'm an addict and I'm going away to secondary treatment. I've been clean for 90 days and I just thought, but I thought, no way. you can't be clean for 90 days and be out in society. It's not possible. You have to be institutionalized to get clean for 90 days. And I just didn't believe in. And then other people started sharing. And I sat there and I thought, shit, these people are addicts like me. They use like me. Yet they don't use anymore. They're clean. They've got life. They've got, you know, husbands, wives, daughters, sons, marriage, businesses, you know, degrees, driving licenses, you know, all the things that I kind of just missed out on because I was just using all the time, you know. And I just thought, wow, these people have got the answer here. So at the end of the meeting, just before it finished, I said, my name's Raymond, and can somebody please help me? And that's all I could manage to get out, and I was scared. I just couldn't say any more than that. Anyway, someone came up and spoke to me afterwards, and then I went back the next week, and from not being able to say anything to the following week, not being able to shut up, telling everyone all my war stories, and, you know, just sort of kind of thought, I've got to get it all out, and eventually I started to go to meetings, and I was doing meetings regularly, I was doing meetings for 3 years, doing a service, all this stuff. Loads of service, and what I forgot to do was do the steps. So eventually, come the moment, come off the man, I used, you know. And what I'd done is I said to my wife, I've got to go down to Oxford to see my nephew because he's just about to go to jail and I've got to get his head together, you know. And I went down there with like a load of money and met my cousin, went to the pub and he having a coffee. We're going to have a coffee in the pub. Hello. And then next thing is like, I said, you know, I'm like, I'll get me a pint. He's like, no. I said, come on, get me a pint. I have a pint. Then next thing, I'm like, get me a line. Do a line. Next thing, get me some Coke. Next thing, get me some crack. Next thing, I'm smoking, you know, and I'm just like hitting a pipe, man. I'm 4 years clean. And then all of a sudden, I'm not clean anymore. And I was an absolute wreck. And I was so angry that I was trying to get people to beat me up, just causing bother. Just wanted someone to knock me out because I was so high and I was just so angry with myself. Anyway, I managed to get run out of money, actually. Couldn't get any more money out of the bank. I'd spent all the money I'd arrived with and couldn't get any more money until the next day. And someone just said, I'm going to the station. Do you want to get on the train with me? And I said, yeah, I think I better go home now. You know, and I remember turning up in Exeter and walking down the road. And I walked out of the station. I had loads of cans of drink. And no one would come near me. I was completely rotten. And I walked down the road and there was a member of the fellowship. And he said, he was Scottish. He said, what the fuck's happened to you? He said, get to a fucking meeting. Anyway, I got home and I was a mess. I was a mess. But I was walking down the road. People were walking across the road. They were just thinking, this is a ball of bad energy coming down towards me. I'm fucking moving. I got home and then I phoned my mate and he said, I'll come and get you for the meeting. And I thought he was going to come the next day. So I just lied down and go to sleep. He came about 4 hours later and picked me up, knocked on the door and he said, right, we're going to the meeting. I thought we're going tomorrow. And he said, no, we're going now. And he said, you fucking stink. to get in the car. And I got in the car, I went to a meeting, and started my recovery again. And this time I thought I better do the steps. So I've done the steps, found myself a sponsor, found a few sponsors first I didn't trust. I thought, I don't trust you. And here we are, like sometime later, and I still don't trust them people to this day, to tell you the truth. But I have found someone that I could trust, you know, with my deepest, darkest secrets. And my cousin always says to me, Ray, you're as sick as your secrets, you know. And so I kind of like come clean with people, and I've told them my story, I've told them my shortcomings, I've told them what I think like, I've told them how I react to life and how I perceive life as a person that's got a mind of an addict, a person that doesn't use drugs to stop that mind. And I've learned how to go through a process of elimination, and to deal with bad thinking, and you know, to use all the tools that are available to us. I've had a period recently where I've had a sponsor that relapsed, and he'd been clean for 20 odd years and he'd relapsed. And I kind of had let him go just before it happened, because I could just sense there was something going on. I couldn't understand what it was. He was just really angry. So that was an eye opener for me, and awakening again. But I had a sponsor, and I used to go there, and I used to go three trains down there, three trains back, and I'd done the steps in 16 weeks with him, and I belted it out there because I needed to, you know, I was going through some stuff. And then I've taken people through the steps, you know, I've done the green and gold with them, I've done Vito and all that as well. You know, it says you get it by giving it away. So I found that when I've helped people, it's really helping me as well, you know, and it's a two-way street. And often I used to do step work with people, and they didn't realise that I was in a bad way myself, and that they were saving my ass, you know, and they'd be very grateful that I was helping them. But actually, they would be going away, and I'd just be thinking, I needed that, you know, the reminder that this is a lifelong dilemma that I'm in, and if I don't stay on my guard, relapse is around the corner, you know. And the day I relapsed was the day I just didn't see it coming, and it hit me like a train, you know. And then, you know, you sort of go back and you retrack your steps, and you think, yeah, I kind of had relapsed 4 months before, I just hadn't done it yet, you know. So the steps have taught me how to see my red flags come up, you know, and I have certain red flags that I think, hold on a minute, my thinking's all over the place, I need to speak to someone, I need to get to a meeting, I need to lie down and pray and say something and write down what the hell's going on for me, you know, decipher what it is that's going on, so that I can protect myself from that first drug. I've been clean for a while now. I'm grateful, you know, I've done loads of service again. I had six sponsees not long ago, or a while ago. I was a regional committee member, and I was doing so much stuff. I had other stuff going on in my own life. I was running the business, and I just got exhausted, and I let that all go. And what happened was, I said, well, I'm not sponsoring anyone anymore, and all this stuff. And it was okay at first, because I needed the rest, I needed the space. But eventually what happened was I started to dry up, and I started to realise that the reality was that the nourishment comes from the therapeutic value of one hand it's helping another. And so I've started to put my hand to the plough again, and I've taken on some service positions recently. I've got myself a new sponsor, a guy that I met. The first time I met him, I thought, I wish he was my sponsor, while I was sat with my sponsor, and I was thinking, shit, you know. And that was 2 or 3 years ago, and eventually I said to my higher power, I said, right, there's this one guy I like and this other guy I like. I said, the first one I see out of those two is the one I'm going to ask to be my sponsor. And I sat with my wife in a camp out, and I said, that's such and such, I'm going to ask him to sponsor me. And she went, oh, who is he then? And I said, that's the guy I've been waiting to see. And she said, okay. And anyway, so I'm now happy to be being sponsored by said person. I've now got another sponsor, a new sponsor, and I'm now in the area service committee. So, I don't think I'll ever be a regional committee member again, because that just drained the life out of me. Not that it's not good service, it's just that I weren't in good working order to be able to do that service. But I did do it, and I fulfilled my commitment. But just in the nick of time, I kind of like pulled back from that. And, you know, I sit here today, I've literally just got out of my bed, to tell you the truth. My son was in Manchester and at a gig, and we picked him up in the middle of the morning, 5 o'clock this morning from a coach station, and sort of stayed up for a while, then had a little read, and then I went back to bed, and I've just been bossing all day. And I kind of like feel good for that, feel refreshed, and yeah, I'm just happy to be at service. I'm happy to be a clean member of Narcotics Anonymous, you know. And I always say, my name's Ray, I'm an addict, and I have a program recovery, but sometimes I haven't had a program recovery, and I've kind of been kind of washing away in the wind. But all I can say is that, you know, every time I find that I try to reconnect to the fellowship has never, ever let me down. The fellowship has never, ever made me feel like I'm useless or I'm not worthy or whatever. They've just, all I've ever done is put out their hand and just held me up. And that's been for a long time now, you know. My first NA meeting was 21 years ago. You know, and I've got over a decade clean, and that is a day at a time, and I'm totally grateful for that. And I've unfortunately watched so many people pass from this disease, but by the grace of God go I, and long may it continue. And I do love the fellowship. I love the people in the fellowship. You know, even just going to my first ASC meeting recently, I reconnected with a load of people. Just going to another camp, I reconnected with a load of people. And I was like, this is just the right time. A very good friend of mine who's here today, came back into my life. That was a real sort of process of healing for me. You know, I'm a spiritual being, and sometimes my spirit hurts. So I need people to pick me up and to teach me how to live on a daily basis, and to nourish my spirit. And isolation for me is a dangerous place to be. So that's why I connect to the fellowship. And I think I'll just leave it there. I don't know how long I've gone on for, but it seems like a long time to me. And all I can say is all the best to everyone that's listening, and happy 24 hours. Thanks very much. Cheers.